once a king with a large jaw and a queen with a fair face. Show me the neck of an aristocrat, and still I would crush it.
Carton, the wasted man. I offer him this or that from time to time, and he bites my hand. It's his nature.
They hanged him over the fountain. A gag in his mouth made him look as if he laughed. It was tied so tight. He's still there.
Extermination!
When the time comes, let loose the tiger and the devil. Let loose.
A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens.
I will not keep you long, Mr. Darnay, but I'd promised this prescription by fall. It's already late.
Oh, please, Dr. Burnett, don't hurry.
Now, Miss Pross, if you'd be so kind.
Nothing fresh air and a good walk won't cure, my opinion.
If that was the case, Miss Pross, I would be a poor man and your darling even less of a prospect.
Your daughter, Doctor, is no small prospect, your money or no. Now, I'll take the message, if you please. Good evening, Mr. Darnay, I am sure.
Good evening.
She's cross, Miss Pross. Well, I'm afraid you've been ignoring us, Charles. We've been counting on your appearance. Mr. Stryver was here and Sidney Carton, both of them, yesterday. They said you were in London.
Detained. In Cambridge with my students.
Oh, you have many now?
Enough. It seems that in Cambridge, learning Greek and Latin are all you need to make your way in the world. It is hard to find teachers of a modern language there.
Yeah, well, no doubt when a few more noble families are hounded out of our country, there'll be more than enough such teachers.
No doubt.
Well, Mr. Stryver and Mr. Carton will be delighted, I'm sure.
I am obliged to them for their interest. Miss Manette?
Is well. She's out on some household matters, but will be home soon.
Dr. Manette, I took the opportunity of her being from home to speak to you. Sir, I have had the happiness of being so intimate here for some year and a half that I hope the topic on which I am about to touch may
wait,
not...
Wait. Is Lucy the topic?
She is.
It is hard for me to speak of her at any time. It is very hard for me to hear her spoken of in that tone of yours, Charles Darnay.
It is a tone of fervent admiration, true homage and deep love, Dr. Manette. Since the first time I saw her, since that day in the courtroom when she so bravely... Since I first heard her voice, since...
Yes, I'm sure.
Sir, if ever there were love in the world, I love your daughter. You have loved yourself. Let your old love speak for me.
No, not that. Let it be, sir. Do not recall that.
Sir?
I beg your pardon. No, I do not doubt your loving Lucy. You may be satisfied of it. Have you spoken to her?
No.
Written?
Never.
Out of consideration for me, I know. I thank you for that.
I know. How can I fail to know that between you and Miss Manette there is an affection so unusual, so touching, so belonging to the circumstances in which it has been nurtured? I know, Dr. Manette. How can I fail to know that there is in her heart towards you all the love and reliance of infancy itself? I know you are invested in her sight with a more than sacred character. I know that in loving you she sees and loves her mother at her own age, sees and loves you at my age. Loves her mother broken-hearted. Loves you through your dreadful trial and in her blessed restoration of you.
Charles.
I have known this since I have known you in your home. But I love her. Heaven is my witness that I love her.
I thought so before. I believe it, Charles.
Do not believe that if I were one day to be so happy as to make her my wife, that I would at any time put a separation between you and her.
Sir.
Like you, I am a voluntary exile from France, like you, driven from it by its distractions, oppressions, and miseries. Like you, striving to live away from it by my own exertions, trusting to a happier future. I look only to sharing your fortunes, sharing your life and home, not to divide with Lucy her privilege as your child.
Charles Darnay, I will open my heart to you, or nearly so. Have you any reason to believe that Lucy loves you?
None. As yet, none.
Do you seek anything from me?
I know that without you I can have no hope. I also understand that a word in my favor from you would outweigh herself. I would not ask that word for my life. Do you think there may be...
other suitors? Well, you've seen Mr. Carton and Mr. Stryver here. If it be all, it can only be one of them. Or both.
Both? I had not thought of both.
No, well, young men never do, perhaps. Was there anything else?
Yes, sir. One thing. You should know that my present name is changed. Hmm? It is not my own. I wish to tell you what it is and why I am in...
Stop, no, stop. Tell me, when I ask you, if your suit prosper, tell me on your marriage morning. Promise me?
Willingly.
And in the quarter known by the name of Saint Antoine, the women sat indoors and knitted. It saved us thinking of our hunger. Some knitted to no purpose other than to forget, others to make shrouds, and I, a list, a register. On the counter in our wine shop, amidst cups and glosses and wine dregs, a red rose, blood red.
Good day, madame.
Good day, monsieur. A hot day. And heaps of flies extended their bodies into the dregs of wine stuck in the bottom of small glasses, dyed there. Curious how heedless the flies are. Perhaps they think like flies at court.
I beg your pardon, madame.
Nothing.
Give me a glass of old cognac and a mouthful of cold water, madame.
5'9", black hair, complexion dark, generally rather handsome visage, age about 40. Nose not straight, inclination towards the left cheek, sinister expression. The English informer we've been waiting for.
Marvelous cognac, this, madame.
The wine is flattered, sir. A sign, then, for Jacques 1 and 2 and the rest who may come visiting. The rose in my hair.
You knit with great skill, madame.
I'm accustomed to it.
A pretty pattern, too, but haphazard.
Pretty, perhaps. Haphazard, well, stay long enough, John, and we shall have Barsad in here, too.
Business seems bad.
It is bad. The people are poor.
Unfortunate, miserable people. So beaten, oppressed, as you say.
As you say.
Certainly, I said so, but naturally you think so.
I think? I and my husband have enough to do to keep this wine shop open without thinking. How to live is all.
Madame, monsieur.
If you're looking for Ernest, he's out working. You should do the same. Perhaps you could take your wife a rose then, friend.
I'm sorry, madame. Excuse me.
Waster.
Indeed?
Indeed he is, sir.
This Gaspar business, poor man, to be hanged like that.
If people use a knife to take another man's breath, what can he expect? He knew before he did it what the price of his luxury was. He's paid, that's all.
I believe that in this area there is considerable compassion and anger about the poor man. Between ourselves.
Is there? You may ask my husband.
Good day. Jacques.
Jacques? You make a mistake, monsieur. You must have. Jacques is not my name. Ernest Defarge.
No matter. I was saying to madame that they tell me there is, and no wonder, much sympathy and anger in Saint-Antoine touching the unhappy end of Gaspar.
I never knew that. Was that true, madame?
I heard nothing, husband.
You seem to know this quarter better than I do, monsieur.
I'm hoping to know it better, and to tell the truth, I'm most interested in its miserable inhabitants. It is no way for a dog to live the way they are living.
I don't trouble myself, nor should you. You change nothing.
Will you take a glass of wine with me?
No.
Take a cognac, husband. If monsieur wishes another.
Thank you. Your health. You know, Monsieur Defarge, I have the honor of knowing old acquaintances of yours.
Do you?
Yes, indeed. When Dr. Manette was released, you, his old servant, had a charge of him. I know that. He was delivered here. You see? I'm well informed of the circumstances.
It is a fact, yes?
His daughter came, and she took him into her care with a neat brown monsieur in a little wig. How is he called? Lorry of the Bank of Tellson and Company. Over to England they went.
Fact, it is a fact.
I have known the doctor and his daughter in England.
Indeed.
You don't hear much about them now.
A letter or two at first. We don't write much.
No. Of course. She's going to be married.
She was pretty enough to have been married long ago. You English are so cold, it seems to me.
You know I am English.
I know your tongue is, I assume, the man also.
Yes. Well, married. To one like herself, French by birth. And here's a curious thing. Speaking just now of Gaspard. Manette's daughter is going to marry the nephew of Monsieur the Marquis, for whose death Gaspard was raised from the earth to that height. She's marrying the present Marquis. No Marquis in England, though. He is Mr. Charles Darnay. His mother's family were called Dolnay. You have nothing to say?
That's her fortune, I suppose. What are we to say, Monsieur? We'll fill no purses in Saint-Antoine, this marriage. So, more cognac?
No. I look forward to meeting you and your good lady again.
Is it true? What he said of Mademoiselle Manette?
If it is. If it is.
Yes.
If it is, and if we live to see our triumph. I hope for her sake destiny will keep her husband Darnay out of France. He is in this register, her and his family, for extermination. Husband, remember. I have them. Husband, wife, father, knitted in the register. It was decided when they hanged poor Gaspard. Remember.
I swear that never did the sun go down with a brighter glory on the quiet corner in Soho than that memorable evening when the doctor and his daughter sat under the plane tree together. Never did the moon rise with a milder radiance over Great London than on that night when it found them still seated under the tree and shone upon their faces through its leaves. Lucy was to be married tomorrow.
You are happy, Father.
Oh, quite, child, quite.
Shall I read to you?
No, no, not tonight, child, no.
Father, I want you to know, to understand that if marriage were to part us, then I would be more unhappy than I can tell.
Now, now, child, I understand.
Father, are you sure? You feel quite certain that no new affections, no new duties of mine shall come between us. I know it, but do you know it? Do you feel quite certain?
Quite sure, my darling. More than that, Lucy, my future is the brighter seen through your marriage than it could ever be without it.
If I had never seen Charles, Father, I should have been quite happy with you.
Oh, you did see Charles, and had you not, it would have been another.
Father, I know it pains you to remember.
You see the moon? See her?
Yes, Father.
I've looked at her from my prison window and been tortured to think of her shining on what I had lost. I would beat my head against my prison walls. I've looked at her in a state so dull that I've thought of nothing but the number of horizontal lines I could draw across her at the full and the number of perpendicular lines to intersect them. 20, either way I remember. And the 20th most difficult to squeeze in.
You have never ever told me before.
I've looked at her 1,000 times, speculating upon the unborn child from whom I was torn. Alive, dead, mother alive, dead, and a daughter who would grow to a woman. I have pictured her, my daughters, perfectly forgetful of me.
No.
I have cast up her age year on year, seen her married to a man who knew nothing of my fate. I have perished from the remembrance of the living.
Father, even to hear you had such thoughts. I am no such daughter.
My dear child, other moonlight nights affected me with a sorrowful sense of peace. I imagined her coming to my cell and leading me to the freedom beyond the fortress. I have seen her image in the moonlight often, so like her mother, this phantom of my mind. Can you understand me? I doubt it. You need to have been a solitary prisoner to understand.
Dear father, please.
And her children heard of me and pitied me, and when they passed a prison of the state, they kept from its walls and spoke in whispers. She could never deliver me. I always imagined that she brought me back after showing me her children. I blessed her for it on my knees.
Bless me tomorrow, Father.
I recall these old troubles, Lucy, to show the reason I had tonight for loving you better than words can tell. Never, never known such happiness in my wildest thoughts as you have given me and that we have before us.
Oh, do stand still, Mr. Lorry. Be still.
I beg your pardon. The time...
He can hardly marry without the groom.
Charles wanted to talk to my father. He had something to tell him, he said. Promise to keep.
Secrets already?
No, Pross. My Charles made a promise, that's all.
We waited, the beautiful bride, Miss Pross and I, to go to church.
So it was for this, my sweet Lucy, that I brought you across the channel. Such a baby. Lord bless me, how little I thought what I was doing. But don't
cry, Miss Pross.
I'm not crying. You are.
I, Miss Pross?
Oh, dear Mr. Lorry, now no need.
There is need, indeed. I don't wonder at it. Such a present of plate as you have made him is enough to bring tears into anybody's eyes. Not a fork nor a spoon in the collection I didn't cry over last night after the box came till I couldn't see it.
I'm highly gratified, Miss Pross. Though, upon my honour, I had no intention of rendering those trifling articles invisible to anyone. Oh, dear me, dear me. Business, Mr. Lorry, business. It is an occasion to make a man speculate.
Oh, Mr. Lorry, don't.
Oh, no. Oh, dear me. No, I was speculating on all a man loses. Dear. To think there might have been a Mrs. Lorry any time these 50 years. Almost.
Not at all.
You think there never might have been a Mrs. Lorry?
You were a bachelor in your cradle.
Well, that seems probable, too.
Cut out for a bachelor before you were put in your cradle.
Cross.
No, enough, Lucy. They are moving in the next room, and before your father and your Charles come out, Miss Pross and I, two formal folks of business, two formal business folk, are anxious to tell you that you leave your father in hands as earnest and as loving as your own. During the fortnight you are in Warwickshire, Tellson shall go to the wall. Well, comparatively speaking. And when he comes to join you in Wales for your next fortnight, you shall say we sent him to you in the best of health. Now, let me kiss you and give you an old-fashioned bachelor blessing before somebody comes to claim his own.
The doctor came out of his room deadly pale. No colour was to be seen in his face. There was no change in his composure, save what a man of business and experience may have seen. An air of avoidance and dread, as if something had been said in that room that chilled him to his very bones. Charles Darnay and Lucy Manette were happily married.
Goodbye, my dear.
Oh, no tears, Miss Pross. No tears.
Oh, you're a hard, unfeeling sort of a man.
Dr. Manette, you should be a proud man, sir.
Yes.
He turned away as if not aware of anything.
He looks like death.
Miss Pross, I will look in on Tellson's and then be back. We will take him a ride in the country and dine there. All will be well.
Mr. Lorry was away 2 hours at the bank. 2 terrible hours. What is to be told to Ladybird, my precious? He doesn't know me. He is making shoes.
Now, Miss Pross, calm yourself. Will you be kind enough to make me a cup of tea, and I will be down presently. You are not to worry.
Dr. Manette. Oh, my dear friend, Dr. Manette.
He had laid aside his coat and waistcoat, his shirt open at the throat as it used to be when he did that work. I was reminded again of the room over the wine shop in Paris all those years ago. His face, old, haggard. He worked hard, impatiently, as if in some sense he had been interrupted. This shoe, what is it?
The young lady's walking shoe. It ought to have been finished long ago. Let it be.
Dr. Manette, look at me. You know me, friend. My dear friend, think. This is not your proper occupation. Think, dear friend.
105 North Tower, the lady's walking shoe. Finish it.
No further word from him. He worked and worked and worked, and words fell on him as on an echoless wall or in the air. We had to keep it secret from Lucy. Miss Pross wrote to tell her that her father had been called away professionally. She invented lines from letters he wrote to her purportedly. I made arrangements to be absent from Tilson's for the first time in my life.
But, Mr. Lorry, we are not sure, sir.
I am sorry, but I must insist. A matter of, well, of life and...
death?
Exactly so. And so I took up post by the window of his room. I made no effort to talk to him. He became worried if one talked. I wrote or read and was there for him to observe freely. And when he had finished, in the dark of the evening...
Will you go out, my friend?
Out?
For a walk with me. Why not?
He did not come, but sat with his arms on the workbench and his head in his hands. He said nothing. The secret was well kept, and my heart grew heavier as the days passed. He grew steadily, dreadfully more skillful with the work under his hands as the ninth day wore to its end. On the morning of the tenth day...
Lorry, good morning. You're an early bird, sir.
He sat there in his usual morning dress, reading in the window. Surprised, I suppose, that I should be in his house. Surprise compounded if he had known I'd slept the night on the sofa in his sitting room.
I had occasion to bring something for Miss Pross. I was passing.
Well, then you will stay for breakfast. Huh?
I'd be delighted. Thank you. I'll just deliver my message to Miss... is she downstairs?
I've no idea.
Oh, I'll go down and be back presently.
I heard voices. I heard him speaking. Is he... Oh, what are we to do?
He is dressed. He is not making shoes. He may be through it all. We must say nothing of the past few days.
On the contrary. I beg your pardon, Mr. Lorry. I think perhaps to come at him from... with delicacy, from an oblique... direction? If you could manage that, Mr. Lorry, it might relieve his mind.
Monsieur,
Thank you. I think I will.
Oh, a gentleman of leisure, Laurie?
No, not exactly. I would like your opinion, in confidence, on a very curious case in which I am deeply interested.
Mm-hmm.
It is curious to me. You may be better informed, and so it will be less so.
Oh, go on, please.
Well, the case is of a particularly dear friend of mine. I need advice for his sake and for his daughter's.
I understand. Some sort of shock?
Yes. I told him that it was a case of an old shock of great severity. The suffering borne down for who knows how long. Recovered, and then suffering a slight relapse.
For how long?
9 days and nights.
You spoke of a daughter.
It has been kept from her. I hope it always will be.
That's very thoughtful, very kind.
I need to know, my dear Manette, if it recurs, what I am to do for my friend. I want guidance.
I think that the relapse you have described, dear friend, was not quite unforeseen by its subject.
Was it dreaded by him?
Oh, very much. It's impossible to talk about it.
So to what would you refer this last attack?
I believe that there were some intense associations vividly recalled. He prepared himself in vain.
Will it happen again?
I believe not. I believe the worst is over.
Well, that is something. A comfort. I am thankful.
I am thankful.
One more thing. This occupation resumed under the influence of the stress. Call it blacksmith's work. He keeps a small forge. Is that not a pity?
I can't help you with...
Well, please, you must. Would it not be best to remove the forge to help my friend?
He may need to feel secure with it, safe with it. Maybe it's an old companion, perhaps.
I would not keep it. I would recommend him to sacrifice it. Give me your authority, like a dear, good man. For his daughter's sake.
Well, I cannot. Very well. In her name, let it be done. But not while he is present. Let it be removed when he is not there.
So we did. Miss Pross and I destroyed the shoemaker's bench and the tools, and I felt like a murderer. And Miss Pross, holding the candle to light the work, said she felt as if she were assisting. We burned it all like accomplices in a horrible crime. And Dr. Manette joined his daughter and her new husband in Wales. When the newly married pair came home and settled back into their life in Soho, we were all lucky, for we were always welcome. One of the first people to appear, however, was Sidney Carton. They had not been at home many hours when he presented himself, not improved in habits or in looks or in manner. But there was a certain rugged air of fidelity about him which was new to the observation of Charles Darnay.
Mr. Darnay, I wish we might be friends.
We are already friends, I hope.
Not as a fashion of speech. I do not mean that. Indeed, well, when I say I wish we might be friends, I scarcely mean that either.
So then, what do you mean, sir?
Upon my life. I find it easier to comprehend than to convey my meaning to you. However, let me try. You remember a certain occasion when I was more drunk than usual?
I remember a certain occasion when you forced me to confess that you had been drinking. Yes.
I remember it too. And the curse of these occasions is that I remember them all. I hope it may be taken into account one day when all days are at an end for me.
But, sir...
Oh, please don't be alarmed. I'm not going to preach.
I'm not at all alarmed, I assure you.
Well, on that occasion, one of many, I was... Well, I was insufferable about liking you, or not liking you. I wish you would forget it.
Long ago, forgot.
A fashion of speech again, Mr. Darnay. Oblivion is not so easy to me as you represent it to be for you. I have by no means forgotten it, and a light answer does not help me to forget it.
Forgive me if it was a light answer. I wished only to turn aside a slight thing that seems to trouble you. I declare to you on the faith of a gentleman that I have long dismissed it from my mind. Have I not something more important to remember in the great service you rendered me that day?
Oh, as to that, it was mere professional claptrap. I don't know that I cared what became of you when I rendered that service, as you call it. But I have gone aside from my purpose. I was speaking about our being friends. Now, you know me. Know me to be incapable of all the higher and better flights of men.
Well,
doubt me, ask Stryver, he will tell you.
I prefer to make my own opinion.
Well, at any rate, you know me for a dissolute dog who has never done any good nor ever will.
I don't know about the future, sir.
No, but I do, and you must take my word for it. Now, to the point, I would be profoundly obliged if you could endure to have a worthless and indifferent fellow to visit here from time to... not often, and never to be a nuisance or to intrude upon...
You are most welcome.
I thank you, Darnay. If I may use that freedom with your name?
I think so, Carton, by this time.
When he was gone, and in the course of an evening passed with Miss Pross, the doctor, Lucy and myself... Charles Darnay made some mention of this conversation in general terms, and spoke of Carton as a problem of carelessness and recklessness.
Charles?
Mr. Lorry has just gone, my dear. Your father and I saw him home safe.
He is a kind old man.
You are thoughtful tonight.
Yes, dearest Charles.
What is it, my Lucy?
Please... promise me not to press a question on me if I beg you not to ask it.
It is promised.
I believe poor Mr. Carton deserves more consideration than you have expressed for him tonight. Or at any time.
Indeed. Why so?
That is what you are not to ask me. But I think... I know he does.
Then if you know it, it is enough.
Be generous with him. Lenient on his faults when he's not by. Believe he has a heart which he very, very seldom shows. I dear it. It is deeply wounded and bleeds. Bleeds, I have seen it.
Oh, my dear, it is a painful reflection to me that I should have done him wrong. I never thought this of him.
I am sure he is capable of good things. Gentle things, magnanimous things even. So... remember how strong we are in our happiness, and how weak he must be in his misery.
I have no need to remind myself of how lucky I am. A bachelor with a family to surround and cosset his old age, in that wonderful corner, a corner for echoes, as someone has remarked, where the doctor lived, I was always welcome. And Lucy sat and listened to the echoing footsteps of the years in tranquility.
Oh, Mr. Lorry, you will understand maybe my fancies. Dear Pross laughs them to scorn.
Oh, that is not true, my precious. I say it is a matter of your condition.
This has nothing to do with my condition, Pross. I assure you, Mr. Lorry, I have always felt doubts and hopes, and I feel footsteps echoing about me. Joy and mourning and
she sat in her muslin dress, as pretty as a picture, and worried her pretty head about nothing.
You have no soul, Mr. Lorry, no imagination.
And I thank God for that. I understand figures, business. Imagination, dear Lucy, I leave for you.
You are a wicked man, sir.
I am a businessman. The bank allows no flights, no imagination. And yet when little Lucy lay on her bosom, I allowed a little fancy, a little imagining. This joy that came to her and to Charles, this child who bound Miss Pross in strings of affection, chains of love, who chattered in the tongues of the two cities that were blended in her life.
Mr. Carton is busy, Lucy. He will come when he has time.
He would arrive in that oasis perhaps half a dozen times a year at most. He would sit quietly with them and never heated with the wine.
He touches my heart, Mr. Lorry. I know he comes to visit us because he needs love. He feeds off all of us here, and I pity him.
Carton was the first stranger to whom little Lucy held out her arms, and he kept his place with her as she grew. The child saw beneath that silence, that sadness, with an instinctive delicacy of pity for him. As for Stryver, he graced the quiet corner with his presence for a time, and then married a rich widow. I saw him one midday. He was never a quiet man.
Well, do well, Lorry. Do very well. Long time since I had the pleasure, sir. Oh, Carton gives me the news from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm married, of course. Widow. He saw a coming man and snapped the opportunity.
Indeed.
I'll join you for a glass. Seeing the client in a few minutes. Just squeeze in.
He did, wheezing and looking larger than he ever looked.
So your friend, ungrateful wretch.
I'm sorry?
That damned teacher, froggy chap. Mrs. Stryver's three sons. Well, got to make something of them.
Oh, indeed you should, Mr. Stryver.
Offered them three lumps of bread and cheese, I said, to your matrimonial picnics. I told Darnay, here they are, bread to be kneaded into... And he turned them away. Turned away a Stryver. Three Strivers. Beware, I tell them. Beware the pride of beggars like that Darnay. Lucky escape I had there. Thanks to you, Lorry. Oh, I tell Mrs. Stryver, I escaped the clutches of a scheming madam. Oh, but I learned a thing or two. No one catches Stryver if he does not want to be catched. So, more wine, Lorry. More wine.
And he sat there so pleased and happy and full of air. And the world went on, and Charles and Lucy, the doctor, my friend, and the child were wrapped in peace. But there were echoes indeed, soft and faint, but echoes that rippled over the sea and even into the city, even into the dull doors of the bank. I remember the time, mid-July it was, and the city stank in the summer heat. I remember... 1789 it was. I sat with my friends at the open window, and even the night air was hot.
Do you remember that night we saw the lightning?
I do. It was a night as hot as this.
I remember. You looked tired then. Now, Mr. Lorry, you look even more tired. You promised to tell little Lucy a story.
Oh, Mr. Lorry, how nice.
Ah.
How are you? Oh, you look tired. He looks tired, Lucy.
Mr. Lorry is worn out, I believe.
The world is quite topsy-turvy.
Why? What on earth has happened?
It is Paris.
Paris?
Our customers there seem not able to confide their property to us fast enough.
What is happening to France?
Well, there's a mania amongst some for sending their property out of the country. We cannot fathom it. People are so unreasonable. Some of us at Tilson's are getting old. We really can't be troubled out of our ordinary habits and customs. It was a bedlam the whole day.
It looks threatening, Mr. Lorry. A poor prospect.
Yes, of course it is. And I am determined to be peevish after such a day. All these hurries and forebodings have made me nervous without reason. You are not going out, I hope.
No, I had not planned to. Would a game of backgammon soothe you, my friend?
I don't think it would, if I may speak my mind. I'm not fit to play tonight. Lucy, is the tea board there still?
It is. It has been kept for you.
Thank you, my dear. Now, put all that out of my mind. Send it away. Is the precious child safe in bed?
Sleeping soundly.
Good, that's right. Safe and well. I don't know why anything should be otherwise but safe and well here, thank God. But I have been put about all day, and I am not as young as I was.
Tea.
I thank you, my dear. I just want to sit quiet amongst good friends.
Poor France.
Vast, distinct mass of scarecrows heaving to and fro in Saint-Antoine. Steel and bayonets shine in the sun. A forest of naked arms struggling like shriveled branches of trees in a winter wind. Fingers clutching at every weapon or semblance of a weapon thrown up from the depths below.
Just one! Just two! Three! Keep near where you can see me! Take the drawbridge! Massive stone walls of the eight great towers!
See there. See the slight displacements of the raging seas made by the falling wounded. See them. See them. Flashing swords. Blazing torches. Smoke them out.
Smoke them out! Bring them at sword! Smoke them out! All well, comrades! All well! Jack Moore! From Isabel! Slaughterhouse! Take
a
man to the center! Be ready there!
Freaks, bodies, executions, bravery, boom, flash, rattle, that living sea, those shriveled arms beating down on the very stones!
The Bastille shall fall!
Jack, with me.
You! You stop.
I'll die, monsieur. I'm an old man.
A guard in this place, a torturer.
I made orders, that's all. Wife and children, please don't kill me.
Show me the North Tower, now.
I will. I promise I will. There's no one there.
What is the meaning of 105 North Tower?
The meaning, monsieur?
Yes, does it mean it? Captive or a place of captivity?
It is... a cell.
Kill him. Show me.
This way. Oh, please, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me, please.
Jack, kill him. Leave it.
105, you said. This is here.
On. A man stayed here for 20 years.
There are worse places.
Straw on the floor. A stone on a table. No light. No animal should live in this.
No will again.
I see the walls. Pass the torch. Close by. Yeah, Jacques. See. A.M. carved in the stone.
Alexandre Manet. Oh. And see a calendar scratched into this stone.
Here. Your crowbar. Give it to me. Hold the light higher. Jacques. Look among those fragments with care. Here. Take the knife. Rip up the bed. Search the straw. You guard, hold that torch fire! Damn your eyes!
What do we look for, Jack?
Wait.
Up the chimney, maybe.
No.
Yes, something.
You found something?
Nothing.
You?
Nothing!
Husband, we have a governor. He shot on the people. He ordered them to be shot. The people's blood must be avenged. Vengeance!
Take him! Take him to the Hotel de Ville for judgment!
I was close to him. Close when they began to strike him from behind. Close to him as the rain of stabs and blows grew heavy. Close to him when he dropped dead under the blows. Vengeance!
Alas! We've no soldiers yet to judge!
Leave them on guard here!
Ruth and vengeance!
I was close to him when I put my foot on his neck and hewed off his head. The blood of tyranny and the iron hand is done. The blood of tyranny and the iron hand is done.